speaking about that, about blackness, there was this recent Vlad TV interview with Ari Spears.
Sure.
And I thought that that would resonate with you, and I wanted to run that by you, because from the things you've told me from your experience, I mean, one of your favorite films is The Royal Tenenbaums, right? And I remember when you told me that, and how you told me that, I don't know if struggled is the right word, but you had encountered in your own upbringing this idea of like, well, you're not really black, or what does it mean to be black? Like,
right.
you like Radiohead, you like indie rock, you don't have the markings, the outer markings of what many people on all over different sides would define as quote unquote blackness. Right. But I remember thinking like the Royal Tenenbaums, I was like, man, like shaking my head. Like that is so like not the stereotype or that is so like priceless, you know, for something that'll set you apart. You know, I even for me that movie's like makes me feel weird.
That's what I love about it. It is so weird.
Yeah. And I mean, to some degree, me being half Puerto Rican growing up in the South Bronx, I had a similar experience where it's like other people are defining for you. And for me, it felt from within my community are defining for me what it means. You know, there's a whole slew of things that come with it, like a whole idea of masculinity, of what being attractive is, of what honor is, all these things.
So let's back up a moment.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's get to the Vlad TV interview.
Yes.
So now, I guess it truly started with Russell Simmons, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Russell Simmons essentially saying that Comedy Central does not play black anything.
Right.
And the ones that they did choose were Key and Peele.
Hollywood didn't pick that nigga. They didn't pick none of them. They picked Key and Peele. And again, I want to make this clear. I said this 10 times. I promise you, I don't care if you make it a headline. I like Key and Peele. I think they're very funny. I love their trailer for the movie. I wonder if young white kids will go see it, because ain't nobody black necessary excited to see it, although the trailer looks good and anybody should go see it. I'm going to go see that movie. Just the trailer looks exciting. But, you know, it's like most black people, no matter how middle class they might be, their roots are so deep in the hood that culturally they still have cultural connection. And like they don't switch on and off and say, be black now. You know, that they don't do that. But that's okay. And there is a group of black people like that, but not many. I don't care where you came from. You got cousins and family and all that, and you got culture that travels with you. That so they are just very funny Americans who happen to be black, and it's really we need them too. But I don't want it to be them to the exclusion of everything else. Comedy Central is a very white network. It's so white. You put black shit on it, that's really good. It might even travel.
Yeah.
So Russell Simmons said, I wonder if young white kids are going to go see it because ain't nobody black going to go see that movie. But he said, I love Key and Peele. I'm going to go see that movie.
And here's the fucked up thing. I am the one black guy who saw that movie. And I enjoyed the fuck out of that movie. It was very weird.
I have not seen it.
And interesting because it played on blackness a lot in that movie.
Well, Ari Spears talks about that.
Yeah.
How they.
Yes. How the voice went down. The pose went up.
Well, it played on their lack of awareness of blackness. They're being open about the fact
to how not quote unquote black they really are.
Right.
And even they talked about the whole slavery bit.
Yes. That
also in their interview,
right? That Vlad was watching it with a black lady, and she said, "Fuck those guys," and that she was offended. Have you seen the slavery bit?
Yeah.
What did you think?
I I didn't like it. I don't love them.
Okay.
I'm not a big Key and Peele fan.
But did you have an issue with...
Not specifically.
The way they approached that. Okay.
Because I guess... bring up Ernest again, because it's another thing that comes up reoccurring, is that I'm harder on drama than I am on comedy.
Okay.
Because comedy is much fucking harder to do. Okay. And I think that they took a swing, and I thought the swing kind of sucked.
Okay.
So it didn't, it was not a... Like, I had more of a problem with Dave Chappelle and the N-word family.
Oh, wow.
That bugged me more than...
Well, you are against the use of the N-word.
I don't use it, yeah.
In either capacity, obviously. Yeah.
I don't use it at all. And for a long time, I didn't even listen to any music that it was in.
Well, that would narrow down your choices, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and then eventually I caved. Because, as you said, it's just me and no hip-hop songs ever.
So you didn't grow up... When did you stop... when did you enact this policy of not using... And when we say the N-word, we have to be clear. We're talking about G-G-A, not G-G-E-R.
Both. That's
obviously, you're not using G-G-E-R. But I think that I know you don't value that distinction, yeah, because we've talked about this before, but that's a distinction that has to be made when,
sure,
because the media never reports it, which sense it's being used.
Right.
So obviously there's the, what was standing for centuries and the KKK and slavery and the demeaning term, which is G-G-E-R.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's people calling each other that, like, dude,
mm-hmm,
in neighborhoods like the ones we grew up in.
Right.
So and actually calling people, you don't have to be black to be called that. I mean, anybody where I grew up, if they like you, they'll, you know.
Right, right.
I grew up using it.
Especially you're half Puerto Rican. Heard all the time.
Yeah, I mean, so I grew up using it. I actually am for people using it.
Mm-hmm.
Within a certain realm, but then it gets tricky with rap music being so popular. Then you're putting people in a position to be comfortable with something, like you're inviting people to something that they didn't necessarily earn or something, and mm-hmm, you're letting people off the hook a little bit too much, I think. See, I think the reason why the word should be used is because America shouldn't be allowed to give itself amnesia, and it should be reclaimed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, like, sensible people know. Like, if I'm around a bunch of, mm-hmm, gay dudes and they're throwing the word faggot around,
mm-hmm,
and they're calling each other bitch and queen, I'm not going to do that with them because I know my place, because they're familiar. I like that people can reclaim a word that's meant to be extremely painful and dehumanizing and say, no, fuck it, we're taking this back. But with rap being so popular, what do? You're no longer saying, even Fat Joe said, how can we say rap is for everybody if we can't have people singing along?
Right, right. Exactly. Yeah. Good point.
I mean, and I mean, comedians have joked about this, about, sure, what you do, like... what's that popular female comedian now who did Dear Fat People? The Canadian comedian. I'm sorry, I'm spacing on her name. Maybe you can add it in. But she does a really funny, she's got a Dear Black People video, and you think she's going to go in one direction.
Oh, yeah, the YouTube.
Yeah.
I forget her name.
You think she's going to stumble all over it like a clumsy elephant, and she's actually she's very conscientious. But she jokes about how, like, she's, like, singing along and she, like, sticks her drink straw in her mouth. She's like, yeah, blah, 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 mm, and starts humming, like, when the N-word is there. Like, she doesn't want to say it. When did you adopt this policy?
Because it's a very, there's a very specific moment for me. I remember literally the day.
Okay, because I wasn't sure if you were just like from the time you could speak. Nope, I'm never saying that word, you know.
No. In the house I grew up in, it wasn't a word that was thrown around a lot, at least not by my mom. And my mom wasn't big on profanity at all.
Okay.
And I come from a black Christian, black Protestant Christian background. So, I had an older brother who threw it around all the time, but he was out of the house for the most part of that time. And of course, in my neighborhood, it was thrown around a lot. And I remember being in middle school and I was starting to hang out with some rougher kids.
Okay.
And started getting fights and stuff more in school, skipping classes. And I remember this day where I was in the bathroom at the old place, and I felt like I found myself practicing saying it.
Like to be cool?
In the mirror.
To be like street enough?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
All right.
Because you didn't feel authentic enough saying it.
Yeah. Yeah.
That could almost be a comedy routine right there, uh-huh. Or something out of a film.
Yeah. But this, it was me in a housing project in fucking terrible, shitty bathroom practicing this shit in the
mirror. Wow. Wow.
And I remember leaving the room and going to my bedroom and just laying on my bed like, what the fuck am I doing? You know, like, it was just like a moment where it's just like, what am I doing?
Hmm.
And there were a lot of other things that went on in my life at that time that sort of like got me out of that environment. I ended up leaving that middle school. I didn't finish eighth grade in that school at all. And it wasn't like from that point forward, I didn't say it again.
Hmm.
It wasn't like an attention at that point. I just felt like I was being inauthentic.
Right, right. It didn't feel like if you had to practice to say something, it wasn't something you were that was right for you.
Right.
Or that fit you.
Right.
Why do you think that was? Looking back now with hindsight.
I think there were a couple of things. Like, I think that as a kid, I had a stutter. And I sort of ended up learning a new cadence.
Okay.
In, like, elementary school.
For speaking in general?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think there were a bunch of reasons for that. I wasn't as media-obsessed then as I am now, only I was constantly listening to the radio and constantly watching TV.
Okay.
And I was basically relearning how to speak without a stutter.
Okay.
With a speech therapist in our school's district here. So as I sort of, I had a real problem with S's, and I can still hear it sometimes.
Hmm.
And it really annoyed me. So.
Well, interesting. I've never noticed that, but.
I think it's more, it's probably, it's just in my
head. In your head, yeah.
I don't think that's the kind of thing that just doesn't go away in your head. It just sort
like
of
the self-consciousness over that.
Yeah,
you mean?
Of course. Right. Yes. Yes.
It's like if you've had like a raging acne problem, like I did.
Sure.
It's still sometimes hard for me to look people in the eye.
Right.
It
is probably not even like,
hasn't been that way for 20 plus years,
but it's still the remnants of it.
Definitely.
Right.
Definitely.
It's the exact same.
The remnants of not feeling like you can look someone in the eye.
Sure.
You're so self-conscious about something that you gotta, yeah, it's still there.
So I found myself, I knew that I was a different kind of kid, and I just could tell that instinctively. It's not that I was my grades were great or anything, but I'd kill at tests, and I enjoyed that. I read like crazy.
You were doing things probably that kids around you weren't into.
Didn't do. Similar. I was watching the McLaughlin Group. I mean, who had like 8 and 9? Like, who the fuck does that?
Oh, my God. Wow.
You know, even like white geeky kids don't do
right. I was going to say, you'd have been a geek like in a white neighborhood too, like a suburb too.
Yeah, like, who the fuck?
Right.
What are you watching?
That's so funny. No, and I have a similar experience, you know. So
as I, to finish the circle, as I sort of, emerged and like my cadence got better and it got more defined, and you know, I always liked big words and sort of like I spoke properly.
Right. Which is a whole thing.
Yeah.
We should address.
We could do
to
like 3 hours on that.
Sure.
But it's sort of, it became, plus I was deep in church at that point. And the combination of it, just like, it just wasn't something that I was used to saying.
Right.
Or used to even thinking about. And I heard it.
Right.
It just was not something that felt natural out
right.
of my mouth.
And you would have been hearing it from kids that you weren't really rolling with in the activities department
right.
anyway. And, you know, like I said, like where I grew up, it wasn't just tough kids. It was like, they just called, you know, like you and I walking, what's up, dude? Like,
yeah.
Like it's that casual.
It, right.
And to me, it's actually a term of endearment. One of the reasons why I like being called that is because it's a sign, and I never use it around people who didn't,
right.
who I didn't grow up with.
Sure.
And I'm not going to walk into a room and be like, what's up, niggas? Because then people are going to be like, who the fuck is this guy?
Right,
like, how dare this person, right? But like,
sure.
But going back home, it's just the way I heard people use it. It's like, you're one of us. You're accepted.
Sure.
And for me being half.
Right.
And like you, not being drawn to like, you know, I wasn't out there playing sports much. I certainly was not getting into fights. I wasn't really doing anything masculine. I was listening to Slayer tapes and you know, that's about it. And I had glasses, went to a private school, liked reading, you know,
right.
that kind of thing. So for somebody to call me that, it's like, okay, I'm embraced. I belong where I'm from.
Right.
So you wouldn't have been around the doing stuff with the kids that were like a little tougher, Rough Rider kids,
right?
That were going to be throwing that around.
But there was that, and there was the other angle. I'm glad you brought up music, because that's when musically things started to change also, because I went through this period where I just decided. I always thought that was stupid. In Rochester here, we have one black station. Black owned. WDKX. And I always thought it was stupid that just as a black person, and it was clear to me that you either had to listen to that or you had to listen to gospel.
Okay.
And I just found it stupid. And I was a 9-year-old that liked talk radio.
Wow.
So,
I mean,
I just started to listen to all for a good 3-4 years. Just in town, Wham and Hot Talk and just like Art Bell and like Bruce Williams and like Financial House. And
from 9 to 13.
Yeah.
Wow, that's beautiful. That's really, like, you could script a character like that, and it would be funny, and it would, you know, that's great. I love it. I didn't know that, but I didn't know it went back that far for you.
Yeah. So I'm just like listening to just this.
No wonder you were hurt when Morally Safer died.
Yeah, totally. So So, yeah, so so this, between reading and listening to all this and sort of my speech changing, and then what brought me sort of back to music was, like, I started listening to Casey Kasem.
Okay.
And, you know, just admiring him.
Hmm.
And that was all pop and, like, pop rock.
Right.
And, like, rare country. There was never any hip-hop on those lists that I ever recall.
Right. It hadn't quite...
Well, you had some huge acts back then. This is like Tupac, Biggie.
Oh, okay.
Like Puff Daddy.
Yeah, it hadn't...
Puff Daddy was probably the first one that I remember on a show like that.
Right.
But you heard R&B. But So in that very formative time, I really was not listening to basically any rap at all. And I was at home a lot. I didn't go out a lot.
Mm-hmm, I know the feeling.
And just like, it was just this really foreign thing. And then all of a sudden I'm in this middle school and I'm trying to keep up with these kids.
Right.
And I didn't really find that interesting anyway.
Right. You would have been saying it to try to fit in, to try to keep up with something that just was like a whole way of being that wasn't you.
Yeah, and at that point, I started to really like pop rock, and just like, and I liked some rap. I loved the Fugees; was obsessing over them at the time. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's when they were just in full blossom, and Wyclef and I loved that first Wyclef album. Like, still one of my favorite things to listen to in the world, and. But even then, they were conscious.
Right. They were somewhat anomalous.
Yeah.
I mean, not exactly, but they were, they weren't in the middle lane with everybody else.
Right, right. And they weren't throwing around N-words all the time.
Right.
And right. I got into, I know, so it's sort of like,
well, the Lauryn Hill did say, I'll be defecating on your microphone.
Sure. Yeah. But, but the thing is like, oh, Lauryn Hill, that's a whole other conversation. She's an interesting cat.
That's a provocative image right there.
Yeah. But, So I just felt like I grew, as I started to be shaped as a person, I was shaped away from those phrases, even though they were in my environment. I wasn't consciously in that environment. It was sort of like, in my head, I was already gone.
But now you also have an ethical objection to the word.
Over time, I developed it. So, as I said earlier, I wasn't even listening to any music with it in it at all. I would just dismiss acts until really Outkast.
Okay. Wow.
I just found myself really enjoying them. And sort of like, as I went back in their catalog, it's like, I can't just dismiss this. I really love this stuff. So, I think I felt that the way I look at it, as I get older, I get more sort of almost libertarian in my view set, in that like I don't really give a fuck what people listen to or what they say, as long as they get out of my way. And don't, prevent me from saying the things that I want to say, and prevent others from saying the things that they want to say. More and more, I feel that way. Now, I also feel that that's a demeaning term.
Right.
I feel that term, that empower. I know that we're empowering the term by we're giving the term power just by looking at it that way.
Right, but there's a and you're aware that people like me and the people who
sure.
who advocate for using it say we're reclaiming it, but there is a flip side to that as well, which it's I also acknowledge.
Yeah, and I'm going there. It's sort of, I mean, we've lived. I mean, my neighborhood's not as white as yours is now. Who hasn't encountered the bony white chick yelling hip hop lyrics at some point? Or you probably haven't run into this, but like I've had a lot of white friends. I've had, well, probably not a lot. Let's say 3 or 4 white dudes that I've known for a long time who've approached me and said, can I call you the N-word?
Really? Was that formal of a request?
Yes.
Wow. Wow.
Because it's become so ubiquitous in the culture that it's sort of that the awful connotation
is completely stripped of it.
Yes.
Which actually is the diminishing return, or is the diminished return of what I was saying, where I was saying that I don't think America should be let off the hook and give itself amnesia. But on the other hand, when it becomes everyday slang, it completely absolves people of the responsibility of looking at what went into making that word so fucking heinous in the first place. And I think that's what you're getting at, where everybody gets so comfortable with it. It's like, oh, now we're down. We're cool. I don't have to look at my place relative or even just my country's history
mm-hmm.
and how fucked up that was. So I hear that for sure. And it's also, I think, in rap music specifically, it's become part of a whole package of presenting oneself in a way that panders to people's worst expectations. And you're making people feel good with music because the music is fucking awesome and you can't resist a fucking great song. And the whole like rebel aesthetic, but it allows people who are not from those neighborhoods to see black people as one specific thing, and that's what always galled me about this whole, about the media's representation of rap music, like you know, now you have like Neil deGrasse Tyson, you have other modes of blackness, but for the longest time, rap music, both as the chicken and the egg, both as the result and the genesis, perpetuated a very narrow view. That's why Wynton Marsalis called it the new minstrel show, or a new form of minstrelsy, because it allowed non-black Americans to just look at black people as a cartoon. That's not the intention, I think, of rap music, and I know a lot of people say record labels were pushing that, and maybe to a point that's true. I certainly think the artists, nobody fucking forced them to do it.
Sure.
I don't even care if there were guys in suits who were in a conspiracy to, you know, it's like nobody forced them to do that. Like, they have options, right? So it becomes part of that whole thing, and I can see where that's problematic. But you're saying you think it's demeaning.
Yes. And I also want to speak on the, because this actually brings just where hip hop is gone, and it sort of brings back brings Kanye back into the conversation, and that he wasn't the first, but he in many ways. He is our most prominent black nerd.
Right, right.
and he has. And one of the things that brought me back to hip hop as a genre was not only him, but the Rush, his Kanye babies, for lack of a better term. Folks like Childish Gambino or Kid Cudi.
Right.
And that part of his influence, not just as a performer, but as a personality, is that he's showing a different shade of blackness that at that time, essentially, especially in his first couple area of the first couple albums, and where he's willing to go in terms of content,
mm-hmm.
popularized something that
hadn't been expressed at that level.
Not at that level.
Right, right, right.
I mean, people could argue KRS-One. Even you can argue, Chuck D to a certain degree.
That's
right?
Definitely pushing it, though. But, I mean, because I think as much as KRS and Chuck D were,
I mean,
or even Tribe Called Quest, maybe? Even Tribe Called Quest,
yeah, of course.
Tribe, but even still, they're still part of that. They're still on the margins of the whole ball of wax that we're talking about. If you're on the outside looking in, you're going to see them all in the same,
right,
as part of that same world. You have to be in the world to notice that they're at an elevated level of consciousness, right? You see what I'm saying? So, like, no, I had never thought about that before, actually.
And I never really thought, and I wouldn't say consciousness with, like, with Kanye, consciousness
definitely not applicable.
I wouldn't say not applicable, but it wanes.
Sure.
I mean, I think that you know, he'll beg Mark Zuckerberg for money and also put out new slaves.
Right.
Like,
right.
So it just vacillates back and forth.
Sure.
But that just adds another. I think the Rush in hip hop has sort of added another series of shapes.
Wow.
To the public perception of what black men can be.
Sure, sure. That gives me a whole new appreciation. I hadn't even thought about that before. Have I not thought about that? Because I know that his mom's a teacher, right?
Yeah, she was a professor.
Yeah, so I definitely thought about his background and how he stands out, but I hadn't framed it the way it, because that clearly had some resonance for you. That clearly struck a nerve.
Absolutely.
So I can see why you appreciate him.
And I think it ties into the larger conversation. Going back to LeBron, going back to Curry, going to Key and Peele versus Aries Spears, where, and going back to my everyday existence, all right? So there are certain rooms that I walk into, big, dark-skinned black dude, where it's not that I'm having problems. It's that there's a level of intimidation simply in my existence.
Right, for people. But then on the other hand, I would think that when you're in certain rooms around the people from where you grew up or neighborhoods like that, they immediately see you as not intimidating to a degree that is burdensome to have to deal with, I would think. Because I definitely feel that.
At times, yeah.
Where it's like they're seeing you as the nerd.
Right.
And not black enough.
Right,
and
right.
It's stressful.
Right.
I would, you know.
Sure.
And sometimes that's in my head. But a lot of times it isn't. Because I know what Puerto Ricans stereotypically value, and right. I know what they expect, right. and I know what they think is weird.
Sure.
Stereotypically, you know. Interestingly enough, the I was part of a little pod of rock music loving Puerto Rican kids who are all older than me in my neighborhood. So the guy that introduced me to Rush, the band Rush, the geeky Canadian prog rock band.
How early was this?
I was like 12.
Nice.
He introduced me to Rush. He introduced me to Jimi Hendrix. He introduced me to Max Roach, the jazz musician. Yeah. He introduced me to Sex Pistols. He introduced me to Motley Crue. I think I was already into Van Halen, but he was a big Van Halen fan. We all loved Black Sabbath. I introduced them to like thrash metal, Anthrax, Metallica, stuff like that. But this dude is like 6 years older than me. Kick-ass Latin drummer. He can play, you know. He was an older Puerto Rican dude. Or he was a kid like me. I mean, he was an older Puerto Rican kid. He was like a big brother to me. Introduced me to all that stuff. So we were listening to like Blue Oyster Cult and we were also listening to rap. But in our neighborhood, you know, you were just expected to either like house music or, you know, Hot 97 was the station my brother was rocking. Like my brother detested rock music. He would like turn his nose up at it and like what is this trash? But my friends were way more open. So that's not a typical experience.
Right.
Like music wasn't an island that like set me apart from everybody. And these are, you know, these dudes are like playing full contact football.
Sure.
Tough, getting into fights, you know, like they were much closer to like the ideal of what a masculine Puerto Rican guy is supposed to be. But musically, that world got to us, which is why in the Rush documentary, they're like, oh, we're this underdog band. I wish I could like testify in that movie and be like, listen, you know, the people rocking Rush, people who got me into Rush were like a group of Puerto Rican kids. Like, and we were like listening to it in the South Bronx. So you're not the underdog that you think you are. Like you reached quite far into like other cultural realms, you know, and like Michelle and Degiocello loved Rush. She would go every year. She told me, so that was a really interesting wrinkle to it, because even though I stood out and wasn't a very physical kid, definitely was not a tough or imposing kid, but I had that with my friends. And then we were a little island unto ourselves, surrounded by these people that were like very conformist about, you know, you like certain songs on the radio because they're on the radio. You wear certain sneakers because they're popular. You adjust your slang every fucking summer. You have to come up with a whole new set of slang, which I find really oppressive and really like fascistic. Ooh. And infuriating to keep up with. It's like,
you mean,
oh,
you don't want to stay woke?
I don't want to say nah mean, and I don't want to say fuck with now to actually mean like, yeah, I don't fuck with James Brown, meaning like I don't hang and roll with like, yeah. Now it means the opposite of what it actually meant. It's like, oh my God, I can't keep up. You know what I mean? All of that to me I found very oppressive. There's a constant expectation. It's like, and look, I'm half Indian, so I look different. I'm wearing a fucking tie to school, and I have glasses, and I have a backpack. And it's like, instantly stand out. So there's pressure. And I still feel that in my head a lot. And sometimes I can tell, like, I'm bringing it to the table. And sometimes I can actually tell it's subtly in the room. Like, around Puerto Ricans or just people from urban settings like that, like, you're different. I don't know what the fuck to make of you, you know? I was curious as to how much you experienced that too, where you're not enough of this. Like, you know, what are you doing listening to that stuff? Or you're wearing something strange, or what the fuck is that? Royal Tenenbaums, what the fuck?
Right, right.
I mean, I even thought that.
Well, I didn't really start to experience that until more high school. And at that point, I was very distant. And I found myself, like, because growing up James Brown.
Yeah.
In a black neighborhood, in an overwhelmingly black high school, it felt like everybody knew who I was. Not everyone did, but it felt like everyone did.
Just because the name alone, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like being named Elvis Presley or something.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Only I think that music has a different place in black culture than rock does in white culture.
Hmm.
Musically, soul and hip-hop and R&B are defining.
Huh.
From what I can tell, obviously I'm not white, neither are you.
Right.
But when I talk to white folks about this, it doesn't appear like it is as... It's not that it doesn't matter. It's that it's not...
as much at the core of who they are. It's not as much
a possession.
Or it's not as much at the core of who they are.
At the core of who they are, and it's not a... It's not... I've never heard a white person say about country music that it's ours.
I would imagine that depends where you go.
Maybe if you went to my perspective
Appalachia or Nashville or something like that, you might, or in that part of the country, it might have a similar.
It might. I don't know. Just from my
right,
narrow
but,
view of the world,
and that comes from, I would think that's a really interesting point. It comes from, I would think, feeling. I think figures like James Brown and music and R&B and hip hop are so cherished because black people are conscious of the fact that when these things get elevated to, like, so much, I would say pretty much all of American culture, musically, has been defined by black people every step of the way. Like, mm-hmm. where hip-hop is now, jazz was once the preeminent form of
right.
music on earth.
Right, right.
And so to know that you're a marginalized group of people within the country that these forms emerge from, that you define the art form for your country that won't even recognize you, and then, I'm not saying you, but like, and then that goes on to, like, conquer the world. That's got to be a source of pride, I would think.
Sure.
And so, I mean, people all over the world, like, have taken on hip-hop as a fucking, like, it is, like, part of their being now. Mm-hmm. Like, every place on earth that has people, that has access to music, it's, like, infiltrated.
I've accepted it, totally.
It's done more than accept. I mean, it's like a driving force mm-hmm. in for people all over the world. That's got to feel pretty fucking amazing, especially since knowing that it's a strange relationship that this country has with blackness, because it's like it's tried so hard to destroy it, but can't get enough of it.
Yeah, I think that's well put.
You know, and I always found that really, like, I don't get that. Obviously, the destruction part I don't get. But it's like, for all that for all that in terms of policy and just outright violence and subliminal predisposition to violence, like, it's like, okay, this country, America, you've tried to destroy these people every step of the way, yet you cannot get enough of what they bring to the table in terms of the arts, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Our slang. We say yo now. Mm-hmm. That didn't used to be something that white people said.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, now everybody says, you know. So it's pretty crazy. But so to be named James Brown, people knew who you were. You were at a phase in your life where you were being distant? Distant from who?
Everybody.
Okay.
And I think it was amplified. I'm an atheist. And at that point,
I can't wait to...
Yeah, that point, I pretty much severed myself from church. So that's another pool of black people that I pretty much had just chopped off at that point. Non-N-word using black people. So I had just lost a ton of friends.
And a bunch of music to go with it.
A bunch of music. and I was listening to the Wallflowers a lot.
Wow.
and I wish
I could have helped you at the time. But
and I had my older brother was nuts about Hendrix and Dylan and stuff. So he was cranking a lot of that. That's how
sure.
my first... And he loved Buddy Holly, too. Was obsessed with Buddy Holly. I found myself just isolated and going through, like, teenage alienation and just... And just musically feeling, like, being attracted to, like, stuff... like Korn.
Okay.
And I was going in like musically schizophrenic mode. Like I was going from like Wyclef to Korn to Dave Matthews.
Okay.
To like Garth Brooks.
Which is interesting that you would call that schizophrenic because you're not expected to be able to be an omnivore.
No.
When you're from wherever you're from, you sort of have to like adhere to kind of stay in the lane of whatever the community you're from is into. And that's really oppressive and aggravating.
Yeah. And I think that at that point that helped draw a deeper wedge between me and hip hop.
Hmm.
It wasn't even that I didn't like it. It's just like, I'm the type of person that does not like people keep telling me I should be my own boss. I don't like it when folks like demand that I have a certain opinion.
Or adopt something or be up on stuff. And so, yes, I can relate very much to like, oh, have you heard the new blah, blah, blah? And it's like, why do I need to... Why are you deciding for me?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Well, and it's not just why are you deciding for me. It's we've made this decision for you, and because you like something else, you're not black.
Right, right. And I feel that too. And it's interesting because it's from within and without. Like I feel that. Like, I have a much less ambivalent relationship with my, with Puerto Rican-ness, if you call it that. I've always had love for it because it's in me. It's a part of who I am. And obviously there are certain aspects that are super appealing, like the food and the way people talk and, you know, and,
sure.
And I feel really great when I'm loved and embraced by people who sound like the people I grew up with, who sound like my relatives, you right. know what I'm saying? So,
those are great moments.
But, or like when, like, you know, if I see a little old Puerto Rican lady and she starts speaking to me in Spanish, that feels good. Cause I don't necessarily look the part either, kind of, but some people automatically will think so. And some people don't, but you know, the whole idea that I have to be a certain thing, to me, it's not only is it really strangulating, but it's also like, well, wait a minute, you're limiting us for what we can be. Like you are, we ourselves are not embracing the range for what we can be. Like there are other things we can embrace. Like I really like that my older friends liked different music,
mm-hmm.
that they took a stand against that. And as we got older and we embraced Latin music.
Sure.
Same guy introduced me to Eddie Palmieri, extremely famous Latin percussion player, like a okay. god of he's like a titan of Latin percussion, like a Duke Ellington of that of,
all right.
of in that world, right? So, but we were like, we're not going to just fucking just swallow what we're expected to be, you know, and when other people, like I also have the experience of when there are white people or people who are not Puerto Rican who like, they have a preset notion or they have a fetish or they have an attraction to quote unquote the culture. And I can sense that they see me as an anomaly too. That's fucking annoying to me too. It's like, it's much more annoying from within, like, because I feel the pressure. You know, in a million little ways, people will make you feel weird. Your own people
yeah.
will make you, and they don't even mean to, they're not trying to make you feel shitty, but they're like, oh, what are you?
Yeah.
It's like, you just kind of feel like you're walking on hot coals sometimes. Right, like you can't totally. Be, you know, any little gesture you make, any little item of clothing. Like if I went home dressed like this, I'd hear about it.
Mm-hmm.
That's really, it's like, come on, can you not be comfortable just being, you know what right. I'm saying? So it's interesting. And then being half Indian, I mean, I like to tell people because this is how I feel. Like I've never really dealt with overt racism from anybody in my life. Like I, you know, I'm careful. But the most, I wouldn't even call it racism. The most sort of like boneheaded shit that I've heard has been from Puerto Rican people about being Indian.
Wow.
Which has given me a much more tolerant perspective on racism across the board. Because I just see, and actually a lot of the illest shit I've heard about black people has been from my own people, mm-hmm. some of whom are pretty dark skinned themselves, but Puerto Ricans don't identify with American blackness.
Mm-hmm. You should.
It's a totally different flavor. Mindset. Like the racial makeup of Puerto Rico is completely different. There is definitely racism there and it definitely favors the lighter you are,
mm-hmm.
but it's way common in Puerto Rico to have a family that literally runs the whole fucking spectrum. You can have blonde, blue-eyed relatives
right.
and relatives that are as dark-skinned as you in the same, like my family had that.
Yeah.
And then some people that look like half native,
yeah.
like olive or a tan skin, you yeah. know, it's like, the whole fucking pot is like you typically in your family. That's really cool. So culturally coming from the Caribbean, you can be dark, you can be black skinned, but American blackness is its own world
sure, sure.
that we're not really a part. I mean, now living side by side, yes. But I heard a lot of shit that you would hear racist white people say. I've heard a lot of that shit growing up. And, you know, I maybe feel bad outing my own people here. But it just made me feel like, you know what? People, wherever they are, they like people who are like them.
Right. That's very
true. It's like anything you can latch onto that's different. You know, like African kids got treated weird in my neighborhood because they're totally, you know, they stick out like sore thumbs, right?
Sure.
And
we didn't have African kids around, but I'm certain that if they were, that the same thing would occur.
Yeah. I mean, they would have just stuck out. And this is the thing. This is why I think the idea of blackness, sometimes I think the black community in the U.S. gets tunnel vision.
Sure.
Because when you interact with black people from other parts of the world, they don't relate necessarily, like they stand out just as much. It's like you're part of this community that has been pushed into a corner and you've developed your own mindset.
Own psychosis?
What?
Own psychosis.
Well, but then you've allowed somebody else's limits on what you can be to dictate who you are. Like, that's not, I'm not saying you black people. Yeah. I'm saying any group of people like that, like it's like, oh, we are not this other thing. We're on the margins of this bigger society. So we're going to take pride in these things we do a certain way. But then without realizing it, clamp down and create a really narrow bandwidth for what somebody can be, within that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I get where you're coming from. I think the thing that that brings to mind, I guess that there's a number of ways I could go, but I'll go this way. I think one of the reasons why, obviously, we're a very specific group of people, and when I say specific, I mean it in a couple different ways. I mean, American black people, I mean, we could go into slavery, we could go through the whole, like, just, not just slavery, but slavery and then isolation.
Right.
So, I think that once you combine slavery and then the 100 years afterwards, and even to this day, being, for the most part, physically isolated from the rest of the population.
Sure.
Even within our cities.
Sure, of course. That, I mean, I can't see how anybody would deny that.
I think that what you end up with is that tunnel vision, where you sort of like you are sort of, I think you're fighting a lot of yesterday's wars, and I don't think that that's not always a bad thing, and I think some of those wars need to be had, because I don't think they're fully over.
But they're not necessarily won by making you feel weird for dressing a certain way.
Yeah,
for making James Brown feel strange for liking the Royal Tenenbaums.
Yeah. Or like dress is another thing, right?
Hugely important.
Sure. I mean, because at a certain point I stopped wearing jeans completely in high school. And that was a deal. That was a huge deal. And the same thing, and I went to Freddie Thomas Middle School at that point. And in middle school, we had a dress code, and essentially the kids, but at a certain point, the kids just decided to not wear those clothes.
Okay.
And I actually won an award for actually sticking with the dress code.
Oh, my God.
You know?
Oh, my goodness.
And then in high school, eventually just wearing khakis, wearing dress pants, and just making that choice, there's an isolation that hasn't ceased.
Even, I would imagine, verging on hostility.
And depending on the person. Now, I think as I got older, not so much. Like, as I got older, there are more and more, you know, I get to know other black people who are, if they're not blurreds, they're like, you know, they're in the sort of, they're in a different shade of blackness. They're not right in that stereotypical, like, lane, and just in that lane. And because even that sort of, even just straying from that lane makes you both physically isolated from the pocket of isolation within black isolation.
Yeah, wow, yeah, sure. I see what you're saying.
So all of a sudden you look around like, hey, you know,
who can I relate to?
And then all of a sudden, you know, when you see other black people who find their way out, you know, there are these very odd moments that I run into where it's sort of like, where you walk in a room and you're in a place where, like, black people aren't supposed to be. Or you're in, like, a certain bar or something.
Right, right.
Or a certain part of town, a certain coffee house or whatever. And another black person look in, and there's this odd moment where it's like...
Knowing.
Where, like, you either, like...
There's
a moment of, like... Yeah, you're here too? Awesome, man. What's going on? or there's a, like, is there really another black person in here?
That's funny.
And it's sort of, I don't know where it ends. Except... More time alone.
Or just feeling more comfortable out and about wherever, you know, I guess as time goes on, I just feel more comfortable, more so, not entirely, just kind of wherever I'm at, and enjoying the fact that, or learning to value the fact that no matter where I am, people's expectations are going to be a little bit thrown off.
Mm-hmm.
And I have, from a very young age, appreciated that not having both feet in any one world, although it's very painful, is a huge advantage. I mean, I remember having that thought it was either junior high or early high school, where I was like, I remember feeling overwhelmed. I was in my kitchen in the apartment I grew up in the Bronx, and I felt overwhelmed because it was almost like seeing 360 degrees of all these different characteristics that different people or different groups of people, sets of people would find appealing, or that they would steer you towards. And I'm like, I can't be all those things. I cannot please all that. I had this conscious thought, and I was like kind of hyperventilating about it. And, but I knew in that moment that this in the long run is going to be better, because people who are card carrying members of any one community, I've noticed, tend to be kind of lazy about going out into other worlds, not necessarily travel, but just being part of other, connecting with other ways of being, because they don't have to, because they're at home where they're at among their, whoever they consider their people to be. It doesn't necessarily have to even be ethnic. But if you don't have that, by nature, you learn to be by demand, you learn to be versatile. And the isolation you're talking about, that discomfort, I think comes with it's a blessing in disguise.
On that note, Savvy, thanks for coming.
Thank you.